Oh, I don't know. What do you guys want to talk about today? Self-driving cars? Tax policy? All right, we can do that. But what about the Fed? Any love for that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 15th of September, and this is a day of two countdowns. One you'll find if you just turn on CNN, and we'll get to that one in a minute. The first one up for us today, though, stands at a bit more than a day and a half and counting. Come Thursday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Washington time, the Federal Open Market Committee is going to do it's going to do something. Raise interest rates or let them stay where they are. It is the economic question of the year, bar none. But here, just for sport, is another one. Why does the Fed have to raise rates at all? Why can't money just stay free forever? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
Things that go down that must come back up include bad sushi, the weight of crash dieters, and interest rates?
Yes, exactly. Eventually, they've got to come up. The only question is when.
Ken Kuttner is an econ professor at Williams College, Go Eafs, and he says while consumers and companies might like to borrow money at cheap rates, savers don't like the low returns they're seeing. Plus, there are dangers in leaving rates too low for too long. Carl Tannenbaum is chief economist at Northern Trust.
Many don't remember, but in 1979, 1980, inflation was running near 15%, eating up purchasing power and forcing a short-term perspective on businesses.
If interest rates are low, people spend money instead of save and drive up prices. So fear of inflation is one reason the Fed will eventually raise rates. And reason number two, says Hamilton College professor Ann Owen, is risky behavior.
So when it's really, really inexpensive to borrow, people will borrow and take on risks that they would not otherwise take when interest rates are at a more normal level. And a concern about that is it could cause bubbles in the stock market, which would eventually burst.
Or housing bubbles. Don't have to look back too far for an example of that. So to recap, if the Fed waits too long to raise rates, we may see inflation or bubbles start to form. But too soon, and they could cool a still recovering economy. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
All right, countdown number two, as I glance up at the TV in the studio here with me, tells me there's about a day left until the second GOP debate, which gets me to this. Twitter and the online payment company Square said today they are getting into the 2016 race as well because everybody else has, right? So why not? The two companies have announced an integrated product that will let people contribute to campaigns directly from a tweet, thus turning social media commentary into perhaps actual cash for campaigns. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more on that from Washington.
Politicians are already using Twitter and other social media in campaigns, and it makes sense.
We have data at Twitter that shows that our audience is very politically engaged and very active.
Jenna Golden is Twitter's head of political advertising sales.
And essentially the number one question we've been getting from campaigns since early 2012 was, when are you going to allow for candidates and committees to be able to accept donations in a tweet?
That would be today, at least for some presidential campaigns and the national parties. They can put a contribute button in their tweets to get donor info and donations right from the app. But will the people who pontificate online actually pay up, or will they stick to being so-called slacktivists?
The sense that if you just like something or share something, you're contributing but not really making a big difference.
Mimi Ito is a cultural anthropologist at the University of California, Irvine.
So I think this is an interesting play to see if people will put their money where their mouth is.
Clay Shossow helps campaigns with their online strategies at New Media Campaigns. He already has ideas for how he'll use this tool with his clients.
If you're going to be in Chapel Hill, North Carolina for a fundraising event, you can target people who follow you and show them an ad right then.
He thinks the service will make Twitter handles as valuable to campaigns as an email or phone number. Twitter says it's already in discussions for using a similar strategy with nonprofits. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
All right, listen, about Wall Street, you remember how I said yesterday traders were probably going to wait and see all week and figure out what the Fed might do? Yeah, shows what I know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're in the middle, as you know, of the biggest mass migration in Europe since the end of the Second World War. And as distasteful, I guess, as this may sound, that is, in point of fact, a huge business opportunity. Anton Troyanovsky wrote about the industry of migration for the Wall Street Journal. Anton, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This is, as you write, the business of migration, but it's not charities, it's not government, it's actually private enterprise that's involved with this.
Exactly. We took a look at all the different ways private companies are helping shape the migration experience in Europe. It starts on the small Greek islands where refugees and migrants arrive, where shop owners meet them selling camping supplies and canned meat. And it goes all the way to a big London private equity firm that owns one of the major refugee camp operators in Europe.
I don't want to get too far down in the finances, but there's a quote from one of the folks running one of these private sector camps, and he says, you know, it's all about volume because the margins are really thin.
The way one of those private equity folks described it to us is managing refugee camps is essentially a hostelry and care business where you happen to be catering to refugees. Refugees, of course, generally don't have that much money to spend. And as a result, it's a volume business, as one of those folks told us.
How much money can be made here?
It is clearly a growth business. This refugee camp operator had revenues of $100 million approximately last year, which is triple where they were in 2007. Another example is a Western Union branch manager in Athens. He told us he's been disbursing 20,000 euros a day to many of the migrants going through Athens on their way up north. And he told us that that money that he wouldn't be making anywhere else in Europe.
Yeah, and he gets a slice of the 20,000.
Exactly,
right? Yeah.
Exactly.
And in fact, some of these, I guess you'd call them private entrepreneurs on the Greek islands, on the beaches, right? One guy ran a tourist shop, but business has been down. And so he's doing all right with these migrants who can come and sort of pay full freight.
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, I mentioned they don't have that much money to spend. But as a matter of fact, many of these migrants are formerly middle-class citizens in Syria and elsewhere and are paying full freight for hotels, even buying breakfast, as one of them mentioned to us. And we're even seeing some competition for the business, for example, among the different cell phone providers down in Greece. So, you know, one of the ways that we found entrepreneurs and business people in Europe are looking at this is this is a big group of consumers that are coming into this rather stagnant economy.
And in a way, it seems that everybody from the guy on the beach on the Greek islands to the guy running the refugee camp, they have come to count on this revenue stream.
Certainly. If you're that private equity firm, their investors include major American pension funds like the California State Teachers Retirement System and the Maryland State Retirement System. They are expecting growth and they're expecting profits. And it should also be said that it doesn't look like that growth is going to stop anytime soon.
Anton Troyanovsky writes for the Wall Street Journal. We got him in Berlin. Anton, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks a lot for having me.
The latest thing in the automotive experience isn't necessarily a smoother ride or better mileage. It's not even a sporty electric job. You know, it's cars that can drive themselves. Uber is investing in them. Tesla, Mercedes, Toyota, and Audi have all shown off self-driving prototypes. Google, in case you hadn't somehow heard, is on it too. Companies investing millions of dollars to get people out of the driver's seat and, not necessarily in this order, reduce the number of cars on the road, save lives, and bring mobility to people who don't currently have it. That's all going to be great when it gets here, but in the short term at least, it's semi-self-driving that's going to rule the road. Our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood has more.
On a busy afternoon in Silicon Valley, I'm out for a drive with Andrew Cunningham. He's a safety systems engineer from Volkswagen.
The system's active, adaptive cruise control's on. my speed is actually set up around like 50 miles an hour.
We're testing new features in the 2016 Volkswagen Golf, and they are doing some of the driving for us.
So we're following this car, and we're really only going 36 miles an hour. My feet are off of the pedals.
And they stay off. That's the adaptive part. So even with his foot off the brake, the Golf stops automatically when it comes up behind another car at a stop sign. The car can also steer itself back into the lane if you start drifting, and when you get where you're going, it can parallel park itself. David Leone is chief engineer at Cadillac. That company is introducing a feature called Super Cruise into some of its 2017 models. Super Cruise uses a combination of radar and cameras to keep a car in its lane and let it see the cars in front of it.
And so it should give the vehicle the ability to track along the road as long as it has adequate lane marking and good GPS signals.
Most car makers are offering some advanced driving systems, and right now they're pretty expensive, anywhere from $700 to $3,000. But like most new tech features, they will get cheaper over time. And all this tech can make driving safer, but what happens if we get too comfortable with the car doing most of the work? Here's Leone again.
It's a risk, but we expect to adequately inform and communicate to our customers that they are still responsible. It's not crawl in the back seat and change your clothes while you're going to work.
Try something like that, and your car might beep at you for taking your hands off the wheel for too long, or it might flash a warning. But that might not be enough. A new study from the National Highway Safety and Transportation Administration found that even when drivers are warned that they need to take control of their cars, it can take them 17 seconds or longer to do so. And at 60 miles an hour, a car can go more than a quarter of a mile in 17 seconds.
There has been research done that shows that this mushy middle of automation is scary because people do get distracted. They do put too much trust in the automated system.
Bryant Walker Smith is a professor and lawyer who researches self-driving cars at the University of South Carolina.
These advanced systems are going to malfunction. They are going to be misused. They will result in injuries and deaths.
Smith says these driving systems can still make driving safer, and they can cut down on the more than 30,000 traffic deaths every year in the U.S. So we'd better get used to semi-autonomous driving, because even though self-driving cars are the future, we'll be in this transition for quite a long time. In Silicon Valley, I'm Molly Wood for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Like most two career couples these days, we began marriage expecting to have it all.
I don't want to say you can't have it all, but it is really, really hard. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 228 points, 1.4%, 16,599. The NASDAQ up 54 points, 1.1%, 4860. The S&P 500 gained 25 points. 1.25% ended things at 1,978. What are traders thinking about the Fed? I have no idea. Bank of America up 2.2%. Today, Morgan Stanley up 2.25%. Automakers were on a roll. Ford revved up 3.8%. Fiat Chrysler rose 2.3% as the company and the United Auto Workers Union agreed to extend their current four-year contract. Late this afternoon, Hewlett-Packard said it's going to lay off another 30,000 people. That's on top of the 55,000 jobs that it's cut in the past 3 years. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.28%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's been a tough couple of months for Yahoo. Top executives have left. The share price is down almost 25% since June. And its big plan to spin off its $24 billion stake in the Chinese e-commerce conglomerate Alibaba has run into some tax troubles. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
This gets lawyerly really fast. So I brought in a lawyer. Here's tax attorney Gary Friedman from Devavois and Plimpton.
When a corporation like Yahoo is sitting on a highly appreciated asset,
in this case, 15% of Alibaba's shares,
the corporation has to be careful what it does with them.
He says usually if a corporation distributes those shares, it would owe taxes on the gains.
What Yahoo is trying to do is to avoid that result by taking advantage of a very particular section of the Internal Revenue Code.
What some people would call a loophole. What's not clear is if the IRS will let Yahoo's very particular plans to spin off Alibaba slip through. Brett Harris is an analyst at Gabelli and Company.
The IRS will never say before you do something whether it's absolutely right.
In the last week, the IRS has sent up some red flags about deals similar to the one Yahoo's proposed, which makes Yahoo's next steps here really risky.
At the end of the day, what's at stake? $10 billion.
That's what Harris calculates Yahoo could end up paying in taxes. There are also big stakes here for CEO Marissa Mayer. Brian Weiser is an analyst from Pivotal Research Group.
Yahoo's management, we're never going to get much credit for successfully spinning off the Alibaba stake. There was always an expectation that this would happen. But a failure to do so would discredit them.
Now it's up to the company to decide to take the risk or come up with Plan B. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
It has taken years, decades, really, but thanks to email and e-readers and the like, the per capita use of paper in this country has been cut almost in half since the year 2000, and it is still dropping. But the paper industry wants you back. They are pouring $20 million this year alone into a campaign that tugs at a few heartstrings. From WABE in Atlanta, Jim Burris reports.
Paper gets a bad rap. Signature lines on emails often remind us to save a tree, don't print. Billers encourage us to go paperless, go green. And when we don't, we feel guilty.
That guilt is definitely an issue that we have to deal with, be cognizant of, and try to change.
That's Christian Fisher, an executive with paper giant Georgia-Pacific. For 15 years, he's watched market share evaporate. As one analyst puts it, the paper industry has been in the hospital for a long time. At this point, there's not much left to do but hand over its discharge papers and a prescription. But there's a twist. The medicine is for us.
What does it take to stay close to a dad who's oceans away?
This commercial, called Letters to Dad, kicks off the Paper and Packaging Board's image campaign. It features a young boy who writes to his father overseas via paper airplanes. But one day, they suddenly fly back in Dad's handwriting.
Paper and Packaging, how life unfolds.
The trade group is set to spend $170 million on commercials and marketing over the next 7 years. That's according to Executive Director Marianne Hansen.
What we really want to do with this campaign is reinforce how our products connect people with what's important in their life, whether it's connections with people, whether it's getting their personal goals accomplished.
Even if one 30-second commercial can't accomplish all that, University of Georgia advertising professor Karen King says its emotional appeal is effective.
I actually think that the campaign does a pretty good job of making you realize that there's certain things that only paper can do.
Like announcing a once-in-a-lifetime event.
My name is Ann Wilson, and I'm currently in the process of planning my wedding.
Part of that process, picking the perfect invitation.
Well, let's just kind of look through. That's the best way to get started if you don't know exactly what you want.
That's why she's here at Paper Daisies, an Atlanta specialty stationery company. Sure, an e-vite would cost nearly nothing, but
we're inviting all of our friends and family to fly across the country, so I'd like it to be personal.
She's budgeted $2,000 for save-the-date notices, thank you cards, and everything in between. For that money, the bride gets more than just paper, says Lisa Laddish, who owns the company.
When you sit down and send an invitation out, you have to think about it. So yeah, I think there is an emotional connection with paper.
The Paper and Packaging Board doesn't expect its campaign will foster that type of emotional connection with, say, your utility bill. It doesn't have to. Christian Fisher, the executive with Georgia Pacific, says if the campaign moves the needle just 1/3 of 1% in its favor, the industry will double the money it's spending. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
A couple of years ago, I did an interview with Anne-Marie Slaughter. She had been the director of policy planning for Hillary Clinton at the State Department and before that, a dean at Princeton University. And she had written a piece in The Atlantic magazine called Why Women Still Can't Have It All, Family, Marriage, and a Successful Career. We could have it, she said, if some things changed.
We can make it such that women and men can take time out in the sense of deferring promotions. And we can change the way we look at both men and women and say, look, wanting to spend time with your kids does not make you any less a committed professional.
Today, part two of that story, Andy Moravchik. He is a professor at Princeton University. And more to the point, he is also Anne-Marie Slaughter's husband. Talking about an article he has written for The Atlantic called Why I Put My Wife's Career First. Andy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Why'd you feel the need to write this piece? I mean, it's been 3 years since Anne-Marie wrote hers.
I think our story is the story of a lot of couples. Like most two-career couples these days, we began marriage expecting to have it all. Equally intense and successful careers, splitting childcare 50-50. Yet as our kids grew up, they hit snags and required more intention. And at this point, in almost all two-career American families, the wife picks up the slack. She becomes the lead parent. But Anne-Marie's career as a university administrator, government official, public intellectual was more demanding and inflexible than mine as a professor. And so we made the opposite choice. Now we've joined only 4% of two-career American families where the lead parent is a guy.
Yeah, so you are statistically unusual. What does it mean to you, and I guess in the literature that you've read on this, what does it mean to be a lead parent exactly?
A lead parent is the parent who's on the front line of parenting, the guy who gets the kids up in the morning, puts them to bed at night, is on call all the time. And that's important from a career point of view because it means you can't really make long-term immediate commitments to be there for somebody else because you never know when you're going to be on call. It's not that Anne-Marie doesn't chip in. She does. She does a lot of stuff. But I'm the one who just has to be there 24/7 when stuff happens.
Yeah. The nut graph of Anne-Marie's piece was that women really today who want these high-powered jobs but also families can't have it all. What about now that you've been thinking about this for a number of years, what about men? Can men have it all?
Nobody can have it all. Parenting, jobs, life is one big trade-off. But we can strike a much better balance than we've been striking. And to strike that balance, what we need is to give everybody choice and flexibility. And the most important way we can do that is to make that choice and flexibility not just available for women, but for men. Because men are really stuck in a career-only option right now, and we can do much better by them.
You go to dinner parties and you say nothing stops a conversation faster than when you say your wife out-earns you. Kind of sums it up, right?
It does. And I think there's a lot of stigma against guys that don't put their career first. Our values are changing. So, you just have to look at the TV commercials to see that a guy who's 30 years old and spending a couple of months off with his little baby or toddler is adorable and admirable. But a 50-year-old guy who cuts back on his career to deal with a teenager who's having a crisis, that still seems weird to us, and we got to get over that.
Do you regret it at all?
I don't regret it. I think it was one of the best decisions I ever made. Being a working dad is liberating for men. We shouldn't sugarcoat it. I mean, it's a drag to yell at your two boys, get them out of bed and off to school in the morning. But it's worth it for the rewards of closeness and caring, for being the go-to person in their life and sharing all those ups and downs. And here's the bottom line. Studies show that at the end of their lives, most guys overwhelmingly wish they'd spent less time striving for the career goals other people set and more time caring for their family and friends. And I don't intend to have that regret.
Andy Moravchik is a professor of politics at Princeton University. His article in the October issue of The Atlantic is called Why I Put My Wife's Career First. His wife, because it matters to this discussion, is Anne-Marie Slaughter, who wrote a piece a couple of years ago called Why Women Can't Have It All. Andy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today in which Mark Zuckerberg answers some prayers I'd be willing to bet. Facebook is going to have a dislike button. Details are sketchy, but Zuckerberg told the company town hall today it's on its way. He is taking his time, he said, because he doesn't want a whole lot of negativity out there. And honestly, it's not going to be so much a thumbs down as an expression of empathy and I don't like this, as opposed to dislike. It was somehow the really happy music 2 days before a Fed meeting. I don't know when the last time that happened was. The Dow up 228 points today, 1.4%. The NASDAQ up 54 points, about 1 1/10. The S&P 500 gained 25 points, about 1 1/4%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer around here is in Shakurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.